My name is Harrison Wheeler, and this is Technically Speaking. This show is recorded live in San Francisco and produced in collaboration with Dave Clark at Studio Pod Media. Our show coordinator is Deanna Morenci, with additional editing and music presented by Notalab. This episode of Technically Speaking is sponsored by Automattic, the people behind WordPress.com, Jetpack, WooCommerce, Tumblr, and more. Automattic's 1,400 people hail from 79 countries and speak 99 languages. Their open source software products democratize publishing and commerce so that anyone with a story can tell it and anyone with a product can sell it, regardless of income, gender, politics, language, or country. More than 1 billion people use Automattic products every month. Automattic also contributes directly to WordPress, the open source project that powers over 40% of websites on the internet. If you're ambitious, energetic, and driven by a passion to help people, you can make a visible, profound, and lasting difference working at Automattic. Visit automattic.com to check out the latest job listings today. That's AUTOMATTIC.com. Matthew, maybe give folks a brief introduction to the audience and the listeners out there.
Hey, thanks for having me on the show. This is great. Super excited about it. I'm Matthew Barnes. I am a design veteran with 24 years of experience from agency to entrepreneur to in-house B2B, B2C. I live in Oakland, California, the Best Bay for the past 5 years, originally from Missouri, spent most of my adult life in Texas, but Oakland's my home. Been here with my wife and our two cats. So that's me.
Awesome. So you're a cat. You're a cat person too.
Yeah. I was a dog person growing up, but my wife converted me. So
why the conversion?
I don't know. They're easier. They're self-sufficient.
Yeah.
You know, they're like design systems where you get them in place. They essentially enable a team to take care of themselves and to self-serve.
Gosh.
So cats, wow. You put food out, they feed themselves, they go to the litter box and they do all the things.
Yeah. It's amazing just kind of how, like, out of birth, they know what to do.
Yeah, they know exactly what they do.
It's pretty amazing.
You can move the litter box into any room and they'll figure it out.
Yeah, I actually have an automatic feeder for my cat.
Oh, nice. And
so I switched up her schedule because she was eating a little bit too much. And it's amazing because now she knows exactly what time the food will dispense. She's like out there waiting for it.
Oh, nice.
So yeah, it's
Yeah, so easy. We have a litter robot.
Oh, wow.
That automatically rotates once it reaches a certain weight.
Yeah.
So we change it once a week, clean it out like monthly. But yeah.
That's next level. I'm still using the scooper. So, hey, before we get started with the meat of the show, I want to start out by asking you a few icebreaker questions. So as with everyone that's kind of been here, and fortunately, most folks I say towards the end of the week have been located in the Bay Area. Now that things are starting to open up, what is something that you're looking forward to do?
Travel. Travel's probably top of everyone's list. You know, just getting on a plane and hitting an island or some European art gallery. But realistically, it's that human contact.
Sure.
For the past year and a half, I've just been meeting people outdoors and backyards and giving like those distant hugs.
Yeah.
So I'm looking forward to really sitting down and hugging someone and having that one-on-one human contact. So I think that's probably, the top of mind right now.
Yeah. And I've seen sort of like an influx of invites start to happen now with sort of delayed like baby showers, housewarming parties, or just, hey, let's just chill.
Yeah.
And, there's a lot of good food out there too, which is always great.
So much good food.
And I know Oakland has a good food scene as well.
Yeah.
Perfect. So you mentioned that you are an aficionado of music. So give us sort of like an idea of your preferred genre. And then who are you listening to right now?
All right, so this is, I'll keep this short because this can be the entire podcast if we wanted to. I grew up hip hop head, the golden era, 90s, I was a big Tribe Called Quest, De La Soul, all of that.
Yeah.
But most recently I think around 2000, I kind of transitioned to more of a down-tempo house drum and bass head.
Okay.
And just really dove deep into it. And so
deep house. Okay.
JT Donaldson, who actually lives in Austin, is my homie. Jimster, early in the 2000s, I was listening to a lot of Four Hero, which is drum and bass of UK. They're still around, but they do more of experimental. So I listened to a lot of deep house, but I have transitioned to a lot of different genres. Little Dragons is my go-to. Highest Coyote, Torio Amar, who's also a local. He's a local cat, but that's been on my playlist pretty frequently, almost every day. Tall Black Guy, you know, who's super dope. MF Doom, rest in peace, you know, Mad Lib. And also Freddie Gibbs, you know, like I'm a big Freddie Gibbs fan. That's like my workout music. So
I didn't realize Freddie Gibbs was also like a comedian.
Really?
Yeah. He's an extremely hilarious person. So I used to do concert promotion back when I lived in the Midwest. And so I never actually booked Freddie Gibbs, but there were a lot of folks that were kind of Freddie Gibbs adjacent. So that's how I kind of got to listen to him from a lot of the mixtapes that they were featured on. And yeah, I mean, I think like Deep House, I think that's amazing. I mean, I was in Chicago for a little bit. Obviously, there was a lot of that there. And then there's a really interesting like part of my journey where I was actually traveling quite a bit to Poland.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, a lot of my coworkers out there were really in the Deep House. There were a lot of clubs that played it. And then you're not terribly far from Berlin. So there's a ton of like that influence that kind of came through there as well.
See, I was late to the game with house music. I remember growing up, I couldn't understand it. I remember listening to some early Chicago house back in the mid and late 90s and just didn't make sense to my young brain.
Yeah.
It took a while for my musical palate to mature to really appreciate it. So yeah, I'm a huge, huge fan.
Yeah. And I think it's good for just like getting in the flow and working. I mean, and I feel like over time you kind of evolve. You know, I don't think I can really get in the flow to a Tribe Called Quest, like at least in the work that I do.
Yeah.
But I could definitely see that on some deep house. And, you know, they're a little bit longer tracks.
Yeah. Yeah. You get an hour mix. And, you know, this is funny, fun fact. I actually posted my first SoundCloud mix.
Okay.
Like a couple of years ago. It's super, super amateurish. And, you know.
Wait, so you're making music too?
Well, I'm not making. I just curated the songs that I really enjoy. Like house.
Okay.
Published a mix just for fun. So
Good, good. I mean, maybe it's a time to pick up a new hobby.
Hey,
it's all about the transitions.
Yeah, it's all about transitions. And that's my bucket list. I think I have an hour. I can do an hour set.
Yeah.
If I can just master like the transitions, I got enough music for an hour, then I'm done.
Yeah. Hey, that's all you need.
All you need.
You can just flip it to the next DJ.
You know, a house music track will last like 15 minutes. Yeah. So you only need like 5 songs.
For sure, for sure. So, okay, another sort of area that you're very passionate about is classical art.
Yes.
Right? So what period of classical art and why?
Oh, wow. That's a great question. Like, I jump around all over the place, but if I had to pick one, it would be early Renaissance.
Okay.
Like the Caravaggios and Botticellis, El Greco.
Maybe paint a picture of the type of what folks would see. So, see, this is auditory.
Mm-hmm.
And we're not going to put any graphics up of the art. So now it's incumbent on you to be able to describe this.
Okay. I'm going to describe The Assumption of the Virgin by El Greco, which is like one of my favorite pieces. I first time I saw it was the Art Institute in Chicago, their gallery. Yes.
And amazing gallery, by the way.
Amazing, amazing gallery. And this was several years ago, almost a decade ago. I recall walking into the room. And there's probably like 4 or 5 paintings in there, and they're all giant altarpieces. And if you're not sure what an altarpiece is, the church used to commission artists to paint these particular scenes to put into their churches, places of worship. And so this piece is giant, extremely giant. And I sat there for like a good 30 minutes just staring at it. And it essentially tells a story, The Assumption of the Virgin, where the Virgin is actually, you know, the protagonist of the piece. Mm-hmm. And everything is centered around it. There's angels flying around it, and there's all the disciples that are ascending up to it.
Yeah.
And so what I like about the classic style is just the execution. And I always put myself in that period of not having an art store or having the ability to pick all types of oil paints just based on, sky blue. You know, you have your orc or yellow. You essentially, you were mixing oil back in the day. You didn't have an iPad or MacBook Pro to really zoom in on that photo. And so what the beauty is about, you know, able to look at a human form, capture that light and capture that essence without any technology is what I really, really appreciate about it.
And one of the things you can also appreciate if you've ever drawn a human figure is the fact that everyone is proportionate.
Right.
That's extremely difficult.
Extremely difficult at that scale.
Yeah.
Extremely difficult at a smaller scale, like 16 by 16 or 10 by 10. You can pretty much master it because you're essentially over it. You're looking at it. You can really see everything at a bird's eye view.
Yeah.
But at that scale, you really have to step back and get a sense of, hey, this proportion, you know, like once you apply that paint, you know, there's no going back. And so you have to really get it right. And they master that.
Yeah. Is there like a modern day equivalent or at least a piece of work that you've said like, hey, this is pretty close to that, or at least I had the same sort of experience of or enjoyment that I did for the first time that I saw this in person?
Yeah, there's a local artist here in Oakland. His name is Aaron Nagel. And his work is probably close to that classic style. He does these really extreme portraits. His use of color, technique, and just lighting is brilliant. And I actually ran into him the gym one day.
Really?
And had to calm down, you know, like I didn't want to run over there. So I casually walked over and just said, hey, I really appreciate your artwork.
Amazing.
And, you know, just really, but his work is, if you don't know him, look him up, Aaron Nagel. Again, his work is pretty brilliant as far as capturing lighting, capturing compositions. It's pretty spectacular.
Sure. And local.
And local.
Which is huge. Yeah. So definitely support local artists out here.
Do it.
And so maybe we can kind of transition a little bit into you. Tell us like your story in terms of how you got into sort of creative direction and sort of what were the influences that kind of led you into this field?
Okay. Yeah, I knew early on in life, and I'm talking about junior high, that I wanted a career in the arts. But in the 80s, you didn't have technology or the resources around you to understand the what and the how you get there.
Right.
And so it wasn't until after high school when I really discovered, hey, there's this thing called commercial art, you know, and advertising. And so I actually pursued it. I didn't go the traditional route. Like I didn't go to an art school or anything like that. I went to a series of junior colleges and then an actual technical design school that taught you the basic foundations. And then after that, I got into production, you know, and then quickly transitioned into animation, which was early on in the mid-90s, and jumped right into Flash. Spent a big chunk of learning Flash, was doing some heavy action scripting, and thought I was going to be an animator, you know, because I love it telling those stories in that way that was interactive, that was constantly moving and constantly evolving. Then I discovered web and really understood that, wow, you know, you have the ability to reach, you know, massive amount of people instantly. Sure. And I dove into that.
Yeah,
and I spent a good chunk coding, really building out UI, and then CSS really took off, and I kind of slowed down because I couldn't keep up, you know, obviously. And then I started transitioning to more of just end-to-end brand, and stepped away from my art director role at an agency, and started freelancing, and that ballooned into an actual agency, and that's when I really fell in love with just enterprise design, because I did a lot of work for City of Dallas, City of Plano, convention centers, American Heart Association, Baylor Healthcare Systems, and so I did a lot of enterprise work and end-to-end design branding for those entities.
Right.
Did that for about a decade, and then I got back into in-house, and, because that's my sweet spot, you know.
Yeah.
Having that experience in the agency side and having experience in the entrepreneurial working with nonprofits and enterprise companies, coming in-house was a natural move. So the latter half of my career, I just been mostly in-house in the various design leadership roles. Mm-hmm. Most recently, I was design manager at a commerce platform in San Francisco where I essentially managed the entire web products. And then most recently, I was creative director at an analytics attribution. I was their first creative director hire. I came in and branded them from end to end, from logo lockup to color systems to working with the product team to get general alignment between those systems. Right now, I'm at AWS. I'm a senior art director of the brand team there. So I've been there for about 7 months now. So that's my journey.
Amazing. So when it comes to like creative direction, are you doing everything yourself or is it more or less like you've been in the game for a while, you know how to execute on these things, and now it's more or less from a consulting, maybe we can get these types of folks that specialize in this or that can do things maybe better than us. Like sort of how do you approach it then versus now?
Yeah, that's a good question. Early on in my design leadership, I was very much hands-on. That's not necessarily giving direction, because one thing you don't want to do is tell a designer how to design. I mean, that defeats the purpose. And so I was actually designing myself, you know, getting in and actually doing the tactical work. Now, not so much. I still do some lifting as far as like really producing and creating some assets. Sure. But for the most part, and this is from past experiences and previous experience, you know, actually doing some consulting work, I do more of the strategy side, working with leadership to understand, okay, what are the goals of the business or of the brand? And then communicating that down to the team as far as like, okay, what are our design priorities? What are our project priorities? How can we create the best assets to enable our team to do their jobs?
Yeah. You
know? So like if product marketing, our sales team, our events team, they all depend on the brand team to actually have assets and creative tools to do their jobs. And so how can we enable them and provide them the best resources and assets to get that done? And so that's what it's more of now, just really facilitating.
Sure.
I try to stay out of the way of the actual design work.
Sure.
Because again, you know, we hire designers to do design work.
Makes total sense.
It doesn't make sense for a creative director to come in and say, hey, do it this way. Like, what's the point of that? And so I try to be that player coach and try to provide them with the resources to do their best job.
Yeah.
You know? And so, and again, I'm really big on just career too.
Sure.
You know, like I'm that career coach as far as, hey, what are your goals? Not just for this organization, but beyond this organization.
100%.
How can I help you get there? What resources do you need? What projects are you interested in? And then just really try to help them elevate, you know, their brand voice, their design voice, and really push that towards their goal.
Yeah.
And the way that I see it is like, if you help them achieve their goals, they don't give you 100%. It's going to help the business.
100%.
It's going to help us achieve our goals, you know, and then you'll look good. So that's kind of my philosophy.
Yeah. It's sort of like tapping into the intrinsic motivation, right? And obviously some of these other things will, at least from a business perspective, tend to come out. Yep. But when you're kind of like, this is a really interesting kind of perspective, right? So whenever you're approaching creative direction, let's say you have sort of like a brief or a scenario or a task, do you have an idea of what it's going to look like in the end? Or are you just sort of like, let's see where this goes? And is it surprising? Like, that's kind of like what I want to understand.
Yeah. You know, and that's a great question because this is just my opinion, but I had the similar conversations with other designers. And when someone hands you a brief, instantly you start thinking about how it's going to look. You start thinking about that end goal.
Yeah.
But that's not the proper process. You can't just jump to the design because there has to be some thinking behind it. And there has to be some understanding of, hey, what are the goals of this particular brief? You know, what are we trying to achieve? Now, is this end result, is this going to solve that problem? And most cases, you know, there is some iteration and some tweaking. Yeah. But yeah, for the most part, you look at something, you know exactly what you want to do, but you can't get there. What you have to do is do the research, do the iteration, do the whole planning to justify that design decision.
Yeah.
But again, there's some projects where it's a quick turnaround.
Sure.
You get that brief. And it's like, you need this tomorrow. All right. I'm just going to design this because I know exactly what you need. And I know exactly what's going to work just based off of a similar use case. And so yeah, it's pretty hilarious when you think about that.
Yeah. Yeah. So I want to kind of go into process. Like Matthew and I actually had a conversation before today, and one of the things that we talked about was the process. And one of the things that I was actually very surprised is sort of how user-centered it is. You know, it's kind of one of those things we generally tend to talk and relate to only around sort of product design, but maybe kind of take us through the process. And, I want to also bring in maybe sort of like what you appreciate about process of art, right? And how you approach it yourself, because you are also an artist. And so I'd love to sort of understand sort of the intersectionality between those two things.
Yeah, definitely. The way that I see it is, and again, this is my opinion, but I don't see product design and brand design as two separate entities. And I know a lot of organizations, you know, the product designers sit on one floor and the visual designers sit on another floor, and there's hardly any ever collaboration. I think that's, again, my opinion, I think that's not the best strategy for creating a cohesive brand experience, because the user touches more than just the product.
Yeah.
You know, the user comes in touch with banner ads, you know, with out of home, with messaging, with copy. And so there has to be a consistent story across all channels and platforms and touch points, especially if, you know, a user's never heard of you what's going to be that first touch? Is it a display ad? Okay, that display ad takes that user to what, a landing page, to what, to convert, to sign up.
Yeah.
And once they sign up, and then that experience through the platform. Right. So what's that experience? Is it consistent or is it a completely different visual experience?
Right, right.
And so my goal is to try to unify those two experiences. And so with design, I infuse a lot of UX practices because I think it's critical to understand what's important to the user,
right,
what's going to resonate, and how that user journey or that customer journey is going to get that customer to understand, okay, what exactly what we want them to do. For example, it's like the what, you know, what do we want them to do, you know, how we want them to get there, and then what's the end result. And so I try to do a lot of research. I like to, you know, talk to customers. I like to talk to stakeholders just to get a sense of what's resonating, what's worked in the past, what we need to iterate, what we need to stop doing completely. And then I go into like the sketching. You know, I do a ton of sketching, even for web just design. I do a lot of sketching. I do a lot of paper testing, you know, just to see if people can actually work through a process. And then you get to the actual design. Because once you solve the problem of, okay, understanding what the customer wants, understanding what's going to be that best method of getting there, then you can actually start on the UI and actually design work. And then once you get to design work, of course, you test it. And then once you ship it, you go back and get more data and pull from there.
Yeah. But
that's essentially my process for really how to get to like the best design.
Yeah, and it totally makes sense, right? Because, you know, if we sort of segment ourselves in these different groups, that the customer only sees you as one brand.
Right.
And so that cohesiveness is really important in terms of just like building trust. And I think there's also sort of another component of just like, for lack of a better term, quality and consistency.
Right.
I think we tend to underestimate that.
We do. Right. We do. I think a lot of times we focus strictly on one aspect of it. We want to make sure the product has a great experience for our customer. And that's super important. That's very important because if they have a bad experience, then they leave. They don't come back. They go, they use another solution. But equally, you want to make sure visually that the stories connect. And so you don't want to have, like I mentioned before, you don't want to have like a stellar looking brand and then the user converts, signs up, and the product's terrible.
Right.
Or vice versa.
Yeah.
You have this amazing product, no one sees it because the branding is terrible.
Right.
And so you want to make sure that those two are aligned.
Yeah.
And so like if I were ever leading an entire creative org, I would put all our product designers and brand designers like on one floor.
Sure.
We would essentially work together. You know?
We'll
still have your separate goals and your separate leadership to drive, but there will be a ton of collaboration and interaction between the two organizations because I think that's how you get your best, you know, your best work.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. That makes total sense. Tell me, how does your passions around art and then also, you're also very passionate about beer. How have those sort of influenced your work as a creative director or maybe even vice versa?
Yeah, art. I absolutely adore art. Art is essentially my first love. You know, I've been painting since I can remember, but I'm very process driven.
Yeah.
You know, and this goes back to the masters, like the whole Flemish technique, which is like the 7-layer process of creating a painting.
Sure.
And so I try to keep this short, but it all aligns with like how I designed and the design process in general. But before I started painting, you know, I look at the photo, whether I'm painting an animal or painting a human, I study the photo.
You know,
I try to get a sense of how the lighting is hitting that face.
Yeah.
You know, the colors are in the eyes. I try to make sure that it's burned into my memory.
Sure.
And then I start the sketching process. I do a series of study sketches just to understand shape, to understand form. You know, I might focus on the lips, I might focus on the nose. And then once I feel like I'm comfortable with that, then I actually go to the canvas. You know, and I sketch it in detail like on the canvas. And then I put my underpainting on, which brings out those tones. And then I start my color layer. And so like I have this really detailed process of how I paint. Once I start that first color layer, I go back over it with what's called the dead layer, which is almost like this black and white muted tone. And then once I accomplish that point, the painting's essentially done.
Yeah.
You know, now I'm just adding in color, like your final colors.
Right, right.
And so the reason why I do that is because I want to ensure that I understand exactly what I'm doing. I understand exactly the end goal is to produce this painting. And the process is deliberate because it teaches you patience. It teaches you to really think through your process and what you're doing and how delicately you're approaching it. And so I approach design the same way. You know, sure. I want to study the consumer, study the audience, yeah. study, understand exactly what we're trying to achieve, exactly what's going to resonate with them. Yeah. And then you actually start that whole sketching process, and then you work your way up to the final UI or your final product, and you ship it.
Yeah.
And so it's a similar approach, just because like you want to be really diligent
yeah.
about who you're communicating to, and then ultimately what you want them to do.
Yeah. And I would imagine you got to be pretty secure about your drawing skills, because once you commit to that, I mean, that's sort of the beginning of the process, right?
Once you commit to drawing and yeah. getting on the canvas, like that final sketch, and then you spray it.
Yeah.
Spray it. It's like the spray mount, not the spray mount, but the actual fix it.
Yeah.
It's done.
Yeah.
You know, you're not going back in there changing anything.
And
that's why it's important to do the research beforehand and to really understand, this is what I want to achieve. These are the proper proportions.
Yeah.
This is the proper scale. This is the proper composition.
I didn't mean to interject, but I'm curious. How did you get secure with your drawing, especially when it comes to objects and humans? I can remember some of the first humans that I drew was from a Marvel comic book drawing. And I started out with triangles, and then I would add the shapes for the muscles and whatnot. And then you got the digits in the hand. I don't think I actually got good at faces until I went to art school. So what was that process for you like?
The one thing that you're going to have to, if you ever want to, it's not necessarily if you want to ever become a great artist, because sure. I don't consider myself a great artist. Sure. You know, I consider myself, I love art.
Yeah.
And I feel like I'm constantly getting better, but you have to be satisfied with the results.
Yeah.
And so when I commit to a sketch, I'm done.
Yeah. You
know, even if there's something that's not properly right or sure. properly scaled, you know, it's fine. Like, it's fine to me. I am confident in this sketch. I think it looks exactly like it, or I think it's interpretation of what that image is.
Yeah.
And so you just have to be happy with the results. If you strive for perfection, you're going to be ultimately disappointed, because nothing is perfect.
Yeah. Wow.
The future of work is here at Automattic. The people behind WordPress.com, Jetpack, WooCommerce, Tumblr, and more. Join a team of diverse global perspectives. Create the work environment and schedule that empowers you to perform at your very best. At Automattic, what matters is the work you produce, not how many hours you put in. Work from anywhere you choose. There are Automatications working right now in 79 countries around the globe. The intellectual and cultural diversity that results is critical to the company's success. Automattic believes in constant learning and offers mentorship and personal coaching to support your growth. As a small company with a huge footprint, Automattic offers you the chance to have an impact and make a difference. If you're ambitious, energetic, and driven by a passion to help people, you can make a visible, profound, and lasting difference working at Automattic. Visit automattic.com to check the latest job listings. That's AUTOMATTIC.com.
Okay, so now let's transition into your passion. Is passion overstating it?
No, no. I am passionate about beer.
How did you get into it?
You know, it's hilarious, because growing up, I mean, well, obviously growing up, I wasn't a beer drinker because I was a kid and underage. So let's just everybody ignore that. I think once I started really, my drinking age, you're drinking dumb stuff because you don't know. You're young and you only have one goal.
Regrets.
So many regrets. You know, you're drinking whatever rapper raps, you know, you're drinking that. And so, you know, I remember it was gin and juice. But anyway, long story short, I'm doing that for a while because I thought that was sophisticated.
It just works its way back to, your love for hip hop.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So, yeah, I don't know what really spawned the beer passion. But I do remember drinking Heineken's.
Yeah.
And I thought Heineken's, this is really, really good. Mm. And then I switched to Modelo's. I was like, this is really, really good. And I was in Texas at the time.
Sure.
And I remember this local brewing, I can't remember which beer, but I saw the can. And the can was really interesting. It was really heavily art directed.
Yeah.
And I think it was like Local Buzz. That's the name of the brewery. And or Four Corners Brewery. And the beer was Local Buzz. And it had a bee on it, a bumblebee. And it was a bright yellow. And I thought the can was amazing. And so I just tasted it. And I was like, this is really delicious.
Yeah.
And that really kicked it off. And so I start tasting more and more and more. And then I start talking to actual brewmasters and trying to get a sense of how should I drink beer?
You know,
how should I taste? You know, what should I look for?
Sure.
And then now I'm to the point to where if I drink beer, I drink beer like wine, you know,
really?
Where I really enjoy it and I really taste it. And I have a smaller glass. Like I don't typically drink out of pints. You know,
yeah.
I have like a small glass so that I can enjoy it.
Right,
you
know? Right, right.
Because like if you have this pint, you're going to finish it quickly. But if you have like this little, almost like a...
You're going to savor it.
You're going to savor it.
Yeah.
You're going to savor it. And so like now I'm putting it on the tip of my tongue, taste those first notes. Then I swallow it, taste the aftertaste.
Yeah.
Smell the hops, you know, the aromas, all the things in there. And so like I am super, super passionate about it. And I even tried to brew several years ago and it was... total disaster, but hopefully
you weren't happy with the output of that.
No, I don't know what it tastes like. And just to back up, like I am terrible at following instructions.
Sure.
You know, I will glance at directions and recipes and then just will wing it. And so I think that had a lot to do with it.
Or watching the YouTube videos and like
fast forward
there, you fast forward it and you're like, wow, you made it look way easier than it actually is. Speaking of the aroma, so I grew up in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, which for listeners is the home of PBR, Pabst Blue Ribbon, and Miller Lite. They have all since been acquired by major conglomerate companies. But I can remember, this didn't necessarily stir up a passion for beer by any means, but I remember going downtown and just smelling the yeast.
Oh.
It was so strong. I don't know if, I can't say that necessarily turned me off, but... Now it is something that if I smell it, it kind of reminds me of back home, which is very, very unsuspecting, especially being out here in the Bay Area.
Mm-hmm.
So speaking of your passion for beer, you brought some.
I did.
So I would love for you to maybe kind of take us through what you brought. It's going to be a little bit different today because we are going to have to describe things to you.
Right.
And when you're listening to this, hopefully... It feels like you're here with us and you're tasting what we're tasting.
All right. So today I actually pulled what was in my refrigerator, you know, because I want to be authentic.
Okay.
And so I have two different tastings here.
All right.
One is Pliny the Elder.
Okay.
Which is a Russian River brewery. This is a super, super popular beer.
Okay.
I have some buddies back in Texas. Hey, can you ship me that?
Oh, because wow.
They don't sell it there.
Yeah.
This is super high in ABV. It's 8%.
Oh, wow.
And so don't sip this out at a concert outdoors.
Sure. Or on a live podcast.
On a live podcast. And so you will regret this. But we're going to try this one first.
Like okay.
It's an Indian Ale. And the notes are citrus and
sure.
a little bit of pine.
Sure.
And so like...
So maybe kind of take it like... You said something about like Indian Ale. What does that mean?
You know, I'm not going to be able to get details into
the
Indian Ales and all the different... But it's a brewing process, a brewing method.
Okay.
And so like if you look at it, it's like a golden yellow.
Ah.
You can see through it. Like you can see through it. So the darker you get, those are more the stout, the more the porters.
Yeah.
But I'm going to go ahead and pour this other one. And this one is a Death in Taxes. And this is your total end of the spectrum. This is a very, very dark beer.
Wow.
I consider it more winter beer. Just my opinion.
Sure.
Because it's dark. It's something that you really pair with like chocolate, coffee. It does have coffee flavored notes.
Sure.
But this is my go-to when I am at home resting at night.
Yeah.
I just wanted to wind down with a nice little flavorful beer.
Yeah.
And so I'm going to have you taste Pliny the Elder first.
Okay.
And then the way I want you to do it is, you know, put it on the tip of your... First, I want you to smell the aroma.
Okay.
To smell the hops.
All right.
And actually, we'll pour one.
Okay. So for folks that are listening in, we have two small ball mason jars. And it's filled up to maybe... About like an eighth?
Yeah, it's like an eighth.
Okay, cool. All right,
so like first thing you do, and again, just describing the color, it's like this really nice gold yellowish, you know, see-through. Like if you hold it up, you can see through it, but it has like this really goldish shine to it.
Sure.
And so like if you really just smell it.
Smell? Oh, yeah.
You can
very citrusy.
Yeah, it's very citrusy.
Are there any other sort of like nodes I should be looking for?
That's pretty much what you're looking for. Okay. And then when you do taste it, like taste the pine. And so like, again, start with placing it on the tip of your tongue.
Okay.
And then allow it to naturally go down your throat and the aftertaste.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So when you're talking about sort of like the pine flavor, is this brewed with pine in it? Like, is it brewed with the actual like nodes that I'm smelling and tasting?
Yeah, these are just different ways of hops and how they're infused.
Gotcha.
Again, I won't be able to go into like all the details and the depths of like the brewing process, but mostly it's like region, like regional. Sure. And then just their brewing method.
Sure.
And so like, and sometimes they do infuse it with different types of flavors, you know, especially like in the barrels, whether it's like an oak barrel or like a steel barrel. Wow. And so like, it's just different ways of actually brewing that process to get those flavors to really come through.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's getting to the point where people are making sort of like customized science experiments for the flavor.
Like it's all about design. It's the same way with design. I imagine the whole process is to test again and to experiment.
Yeah.
Because there's nothing wrong. I mean, think about hazy IPAs.
Sure.
I mean, you know, beer's always been filtered and a brewery in the Northeast decided to not filter it. Now we have a hazy IPAs.
Right,
and
right.
That wasn't a thing until now. And so it's all about experimenting and testing, getting user feedback, and then going back and iterating and then really just not necessarily following any trends, but trying to be that trendsetter as far as like what that next thing is going to be.
It's sort of a testament that there is someone out there that will enjoy it. And then like my question for you is like, has this been sort of like an acquired taste? There's so many different types of beers. So were you only drinking one type of beer at once or has it just kind of been a progressive sort of thing with you?
Yeah, I've always been a big IPA. And it goes back to just my palate. I have a very bitter palate. Like I love black coffee. I love unsweetened tea. Anything that's really, really bitter has a really nice bite. IPAs, double IPAs, triple IPAs. They have a really strong hop presence.
Right.
And some people hate it because like the taste can be extremely bitter and shocking, especially that first taste.
Yeah.
You know, when it first hits your tongue, there's a bit of a bite. But once you get halfway through, Your palate is settled and adjusted.
Yeah.
And it provides like a really nice cooling experience. And so like, and then I switched to, not necessarily switch, but I jumped, of course, in the winters to like stouts and porters, just because these are like dessert beers, in my opinion.
Right, right.
And these are beers that like this Death and Taxes, which is a dark ale. Like I can sip on this for a couple hours.
Yeah.
Know, just because like it is a really great experience and you're not really just sitting out pounding these beers.
Right.
You're not pounding any of these beers just because of the high ABV. They're made to enjoy. Now, if I'm day drinking, I'm going to stick to the wheat beers. They're very low in alcohol.
Is wheat sort of like all year versus seasonal?
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
And so they're very light, super refreshing, very crisp, very, some of them are citrus forward. A lot of them are more wheat forward. But yeah, just kind of my go-to.
Yeah. So I have a question for you, a personal question. And this is just one of the things that I've noticed over time. There are people that can like work while drinking beer. Is that you?
No, No. I do not mix work and beer. And most of all, because like I do want to respect the time you know, that I'm giving to the organization that 100%. I'm working. And unless we have a special occasion where the team is doing a happy hour and then, you know, it's totally fine to do that. But no, I stick to water, LaCroix and coffee. Don't mix the two because you don't make sure that you know you're in your right state of mind.
Right. That's your work.
And you don't want to get in the habit of doing things that are not necessarily, you know, best practice as far as like really.
I've seen, you know, scenarios around like hackathons where people will drink in beer into the night. I'm like, I don't know how you all can do that.
Oh, you like work or I take work so serious.
Yeah.
As far and not necessarily like the actual execution part because like we're not saving lives. But as far as like what you give to an organization,
100%.
You know, organization trusts you to be at home, especially 100%. In this area. They give you the flexibility. So you want to make sure that you're being authentic, you're being trustworthy,
and, for sure.
You're doing your best work. So
for sure.
Yeah, I typically wait until I'm off, and then I'll go and crack. I have something to look forward to.
Yeah.
So it's like in the back of my mind, it's like, okay, 30 more minutes, and then I can go sit outside with this nice, cold, crisp IPA.
And it's better. You don't have to focus on
it. Yeah, you don't have to focus on it. You have to think about
yourself.
It. Right, exactly, exactly.
All right. Now we've got sort of the stout you said.
Yeah, this is a Death and Taxes.
Okay.
This is like Moonlight Brewing. And for those that can't see it, it is dark. You can't see it through. It's like if you hold up to a light, you won't be able to see through any of that.
No.
Now, you'll be able to taste the notes are coffee and chocolate. Mm. So same thing. You taste, smell it. You can smell the aromas.
So what's like the aroma that I'm... This is a little bit of like chocolate, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Kind of smells a bit like a Tootsie Roll. I don't, you know, I don't... If you're younger, maybe you don't eat Tootsie Rolls anymore, but that's kind of what I'm smelling. Now time to taste it.
Yeah.
Whoa.
Yeah, that's nice.
That's pretty smooth.
Yeah, that's real
smooth. It's actually really refreshing.
It is. And it's surprisingly refreshing because typical dark beers like stouts and porters, they're very thick.
Wow.
They're very thick. It's almost like you can chew it. But this one is light.
This is really good.
It's a light dark beer, right? It's one of my favorites.
Wow. It actually was like very refreshing. It's getting a little warm in here. And so when I drank that, I was like, oh, that tastes pretty good. And there's not a bite.
No, there's no bite.
Wow.
There's no bite. It's really smooth. It goes down smooth.
Yeah. I can see how you can sip on this really slowly and really enjoy it throughout the day. My whole thought on darker beers is that, you know, again, like they're super, super heavy.
Yep.
And almost to the point where it would kind of slow you down. But I really enjoyed that one.
Yeah, there are some out there that are very, I can't think of the names, but they're very heavy, very stouty. Like, as a matter of fact, I spent some time, my wife traveled for work for a few years ago.
Yeah.
And it took her to Dublin, Ireland.
Wow.
And I was fortunate to go with her. And it was Guinness all day.
Yeah.
All day, every day, to the point to where I probably gained a good 6-7 pounds, you know, on that trip. But it was the Guinness there. I don't know what it was, but it was fantastic and delicious.
Really?
And it might have just been because I was in Ireland.
Yeah.
But the mindset. The mindset. And everywhere you walked, it's like a pint. Like, might as well.
Yeah. Don't mind if I do. It reminds me of, like, you know, this is going to be a terrible comparison, but it's like I took my parents down to Monterey to visit, and we were on the Fisherman's Wharf, and yeah, we just had clam chowder samples all day. And we were like, why not?
Why not?
And it never gets old.
It doesn't get old.
Yeah.
Like, why not?
Yeah.
You're here.
So in terms of Guinness and this, like, what do you rank it?
Oh, what is this? It's so hard to rank beers just because it's different brewing process. It's different flavors, different tones. But I don't even drink Guinness here, which is weird.
Sure.
You know, like, I enjoyed that moment in Dublin, and it was fantastic, but I haven't touched it since.
Right.
Not because I don't like it, but it's just there's so many other beers. Like, I typically stick with Russian River, which is Pliny the Elder. Humble Sea is my new go-to, and they have some delicious IPAs, and then Hen House. Those are like my three that I'll rotate in between. Yeah. But as far as ranking, like, if I had to pick one, I mean, it would probably be Humble Sea right now. Mm. Their IPAs are just fantastic, and so, like, that's pretty much my go-to.
So everybody, it's Friday. You have your beer suggestions that we're giving you. And they're, you know, for folks in California, they're actually local to California, both of these.
Mm-hmm.
So again, just keeping it local.
Keeping it local. California has some amazing beer in addition to the wine. The wine is fantastic here. It's best in the world. But the beer is also amazing. So check it out. Check out all the local breweries here and support them.
So in terms of just like when you're tasting, I'd love to maybe, you know, we kind of talked about process. Is there a way to appreciate a beer? Can you taste the process sort of when you're drinking it? And then I'd maybe want to kind of know, is that the same way you kind of see some of the best work of art or even design, creative work? Is it understanding that they went through sort of like this process to get there to something that is a bit more refined and accessible?
Yeah, that's great. I approach everything and the way that I taste beer, the way that I buy beer is based on the entire story, entire narrative. If you look at this Death and Taxes can, the artwork is reminiscent of, like, it's really aggressive illustration style.
Mm.
And to me, that's probably a story behind that. And so I usually try to find an interest and dive deep into that. And the way that I see that is the way about design, how there is a process and a story.
Right.
Everything that we're doing. And again, the ultimate goal is to provide and to produce, like, this amazing product for consumers to digest, because you want them to convert. You want them to come back and enjoy it again. And so I look at everything from not just the tasty notes, but to the art direction of the can.
Right.
Because there's some thought and consideration. Laughing Monk Brewery, you know, they have a ton of art-directed series cans based upon all types of themes. And so there's some thought into that.
Yeah.
There's some thoughts to consider on their audience. And so I approach design the same way is, again, you know, what is the goal of this piece? You know, what we want the user to do, and then how we want to give them delight. You know?
Yeah.
Like the artwork on the cans, that delightful moment that gets you to come back more over and over again. And
yeah.
So like, that's essentially how I approach it.
And I really appreciate the fact that we had this question because it also comes back to sort of that moment where it hits you with the can and yeah. then you tasted it. And I think that's a part I actually never really thought about is sort of like the packaging and the story behind it.
Right.
Right. And I would probably maybe connect the dots there. Artwork is the same way.
Yeah.
Right. It's telling a story. It doesn't exist. Like the artwork itself actually doesn't exist in a vacuum. It's actually about the context.
Mm-hmm.
I can really appreciate that.
Yeah. I mean, art, if you think about it, if you look at any true masters out there, that masterpiece, again, I'm going to use Assumption of the Virgin, that captured a moment in time.
Yeah.
And that moment in time will be forever in that painting for the rest of the life, for the rest of the history of the world.
Yeah.
And the same thing with beer. You know, there's this recipe that's out there in the world. And it could change over time, but the core element is still, the foundation is still the same.
Right.
And the same thing applies to design. You know, a company or organization can constantly evolve their brand, but that foundational elements are still there.
Yeah.
And so they are connected, and the way that it approach it is similar.
Yeah. So a couple of days ago, I had the UX Research Corner on the show. And through that show, we somehow ended up planning like their next vacation and meetup. And I think there's some interesting opportunities here between the artwork that you do and potentially doing some beer tasting.
Oh,
is that something that you've kind of been thinking about doing now that things are also kind of opening up too?
Yeah, I definitely thought about trying to come up with some type of art theme.
You know,
not necessarily a paint by numbers. I know they have the wine and paint.
Sure.
Have like a beer and paint, but like have different themes. Yeah, I'm definitely exploring some ways to infuse art and my passion for beer. And so there's some things that I definitely want to consider, especially once things open up. I might try to find a space or a partner and make that happen.
Amazing. And then how can folks sort of see some of the art that you've been working on?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can go to my website, mbarnesart.com. Follow me on Instagram, also mbarnesart. Twitter, mbarnesart, consistency and continuity.
So,
and also I'm on LinkedIn by my name, but you can find me on Twitter, Instagram, and of course my website.
Amazing. Well, look, folks, I'm super happy that you were able to join us and we were able to go through some of your favorite beers, and it's heating up outside. And so we're officially in summer, and this is going to be a great weekend, and we'll be looking forward to whatever you decide to do in terms of, you know, beer tasting and painting if possible. But thank you again.
Thank you. This was great.
Yeah, great. This was fun. This was fun. For everyone that's tuning in, thank you. I can't express that enough. This is for sure has been a first for me. Obviously for SF Design Week. And it's been a treat to really be able to bring on a ton of talented folks from all around the world, actually, to really share their stories and their passions with you. As we're starting to kind of sign off, you can follow Technically Speaking on any major podcast platform. Follow Technically Speaking on Twitter, on Instagram. You can get all of that stuff at gettechnical.io. I'm your host, Harrison Wheeler, once again. And enjoy the rest of San Francisco Design Week. This is the conclusion of the week stream, but there are still a lot of amazing events until Sunday. And I think there's a few the week after next. But again, this is Matt Barnes and Harrison Wheeler, and we're signing off. Thank you.
Thank you.